Bon, je vais peut-être dire quelques mots en introduction. Donc, comme vous le savez, on a le plaisir d'accueillir le professeur Andrew Minnis de l'Université Columbia et de la Fondation Prime pour une période d'un mois au Collège de France. Et Andy va donner 4 cours. Maybe I now switch to English. The lectures will be in English. The general title of the lecture is Design and Control of Co-edited Electron Theory and Practice, and I especially like the title of the first one, Co-edited Electron Compounds, what do they do, what do we want them to do, and how do we get them to actually do it. So there is no need to really make a long introduction for Andy. I guess everybody in the room knows that he's one of the world leaders in transmatter theory, especially when it comes to co-edited electronic matter. And he's been also a long-time friend, and aficionado of not only this group in Paris, but also several other experimental teams, in particular in the Paris area. So we are really very proud to have a long-time friend and colleague and collaborator to visit again. And so thank you, Andy, for being able to step aside for a few months and come here. And without further ado, I'll let you tell us what you want to do.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the invitation and the introduction. It's indeed an honor and a privilege to be here, as Anton said. Longtime aficionado of French science. So I hope to have the opportunity while I'm here to discuss with many of you about all the interesting things that are going on. About the lectures I want to give. In one sense, I want to apologize in advance. The purpose of many lectures is to teach the audience something, and the purpose of these lectures is in part to teach me something. Right. So I want to talk about non-equilibrium physics of correlated electron systems. And this is a subject in which I haven't published much, which I feel is interesting and important. And these lectures are my attempt to organize my thoughts on the state of the field, what has been established, what's going on, what are the open questions, what are the important issues. So, with that said, I also wanted to say that these lectures are intended to be informal. Please don't hesitate to ask questions, raise objections, make discussions at any point throughout. Now, as you see, I have modified slightly the title I originally gave Antoine, although I will cover to a certain degree the material listed in the title that I gave you. Right. But look, at the general subject of these lectures is the out-of-equilibrium physics of strongly interacting electron systems. And what I want to do in this lecture is really motivate that subject, both in terms of the phenomena that one wants to address and the obstacles one has to addressing it. So I thought I should start by reminding you of what we mean by non-equilibrium. So basically, there are two, broadly speaking, ways to drive a system experimentally out of equilibrium. The first is to make some kind of transient perturbation. You take a system and you shake it in some way, and then you see, and then you stop, and you see what happens. Right? In practical terms, if you're dealing with electron systems, what that means primarily by shaking is you excite many electrons out of the ground state into some other state, and then you see what happens to the system. Right. The alternative non-equilibrium effect is a steady state drive. Right? You can just take a system and subject it to a time translation invariant driving force. Right? For electronic materials, the two most obvious kinds of steady state drive are to provide a DC electrical current or heat current flowing through the sample, or to provide an oscillating field. Right? And I want to discuss both of these. All right, so here I should now like to give you a couple of examples. And for those of you who are not correlated electron aficionados, don't worry too much about the details and the bright colors. I will explain these later as things go on. So here is a material, calcium ruthenium oxide, or calcium strontium ruthenium oxide, which has been of interest to many people, including some of this in this room, because in equilibrium it exhibits a wide variety of electronic phases, shown here by different colors. So there's a high temperature phase. Oh, I'm sorry, I should have said this phase diagram displays temperature on a logarithmic scale on the vertical axis, and chemical composition, in particular changing from calcium ruthenium O2 at the left to pure strontium ruthenium O2 on the right, and these are compounds in between. Changing calcium for strontium changes subtle aspects of the crystal structure, but doesn't change the basic electron concentration. All right, so this material exhibits many different electronic phases which are interesting, including a basic paramagnetic metal, an insulator, various magnetically ordered states, and a unconventional and what we believe now is time reversal symmetry breaking P-wave superconductor. Right. So this is a family of materials which is of interest. The experiments I want to talk about refer to this N member, pure calcium ruthenium O2, where this is a little bit squashed because this is a log scale, but basically a little bit above room temperature, there is a transition from a paramagnetic metal, which is shown in white here, to an insulator with no particular magnetic order. That's shown in this kind of brown color. And then when you lower the temperature further, you get into an anti-ferromagnetic insulating phase. All right, so this behavior is believed to be due to strong electron-electron interactions. And the group of Yoshi Maino in Kyoto asked, what happens if I subject this to a current? Now here, in fact, this is just the details of what's going on the left side of the phase diagram here. This is the electrical resistance, just linear response, basically equilibrium electrical resistance, plotted on a log scale, plotted versus temperature on a linear scale. So x equals zero is the left-hand side here. And you see that the resistance is large, 10 ohm centimeters, at room temperature and simply increases rapidly. As you replace a bit of the calcium by strontium, the resistivity gets less, and eventually it just becomes a basically nice metal. All right. Now you see it's not shown for this red curve, x equals zero, because the metal insulator transition temperature is higher than the highest temperature they measured, although not by much. You see that the metal insulator transition is first order. You have a metallic phase with a not too large and basically constant resistivity, and then it jumps to an insulating state. And as you add calcium, as you add strontium, the temperature of the jump goes down. All right. The other point I wanted to show here was that the metal insulator transition is accompanied by a magnetic transition, which shows up here. And the only point of this plot is that the magnetic transitions are generically, especially for the lower doping, like 0.06, at temperatures which are below the metal insulator transition. So you get an insulating phase even though you don't have magnetic order. Right. That's why this, in particular, this insulating phase is identified as a Mott insulating state. Okay, now, the interesting thing that the Maino group found was that if you cool the sample through the transition in the presence of a DC current, the metallic state persists. This is a slightly uncomfortable plot which shows the current versus voltage at room temperature for this pure calcium N member, where at room temperature it's in an insulating state. So if you apply a small voltage, you have no current. The resistance is very high. If you apply a relatively large voltage, well, 40 volts per centimeter isn't that large in atomic terms, what you discover is a high current. Right. So you have two states, a metallic state and an insulating state, which you can toggle between by applying a current. Right. And in particular, although it's not shown here, if you cool the system from high temperature in the presence of a flowing current of, let's say, this order of magnitude, it stays in the metallic state down to a quite low temperature. All right. So that's the experimental result. Now, your first reaction is not to believe it, or more precisely, to believe the data, but say that there's a trivial explanation. For example, if you're passing a current through the system, you have heating, right? Just the current generates via I squared R some heating. So maybe all you're doing is keeping the sample above its actual metal insulator transition temperature, right? They know now that this is not the case. There are a variety of things you can do, ranging from simple estimates of how much power you're actually dissipating and how much power they're pulling out of the sample, to this more sophisticated experiment where they took the sample, which is doing this, and they used a sensitive bolometer to look at what the actual temperature is of the sample, right? And what you see is that you can hold the temperature of the sample at any temperature you want in this range by aggressive enough cooling. You can monitor the temperature by this qualitatively sketched apparatus, and you can measure the resistivity. And what you see is that at high current, you maintain a low and not exponentially increasing resistivity, right? So the effect is not trivial heating. Now, the next thing you might say is that it's non-trivial heating, right? We know that many materials, and I will come back to this, but many materials with interesting electronic properties have phase transitions which are first order, like what I showed you, and which are associated with multi-phase coexistence. So that the sample doesn't transform completely, you have domains of one kind of phase embedded in a background of another kind of phase. You can see this in measurements of high TC superconductors, where these two phases, what you're seeing here is regions of different sizes of gap, basically. You can see this in vanadium dioxide, another material I'll come back to, where basically blue represents insulator, green to red represents metal, and you see over this very narrow temperature range that the transition is first order, and you have metal, you have increasing regions of insulator until the metal all goes away. So you might say that the problem with this is that you have, let's say, relatively small metallic channels in an insulating background. These metallic channels are locally heated because they carry a high current, because they have a small volume fraction, and the temperature of these metallic channels is still high enough to keep them metallic, even though the bulk of the sample is insulating. So you could imagine a phase separation story of that sort, right? And again, they know that this isn't the case. The reason, and I will also come back to this later, is that this metal insulator transition is associated with a particular lattice distortion, which is sketched here. Basically, each ruthenium atom is in the middle of an octahedron of oxygen, right? And the two phases in equilibrium, the high temperature metal and the low temperature insulator, are distinguished by the shape of this octahedron, in particular distinguished by the length of the apical oxygen bond. The Z direction, you see the metal has a long bond, the insulator has a short bond, right? So that's a change associated with the transition, which I may come back to in later lectures or may not, and it's easy to pick up. Seeing that kind of vertical axis bond length is a relatively straightforward scattering experiment. So what you see, and I forgot to put here the equilibrium thing, but here you see the equilibrium structure. This is a X-ray scattering intensity in a particular range. Actually, they present this in terms of angle. But this peak corresponds to the short bond. This is in reciprocal space. This peak position here corresponds to the equilibrium position of the long bond, right? And if you do this as a function of temperature, what you see is at high temperatures, the peak is here. There's a little intermediate temperature region where you get two peaks, and then at low temperatures, the peak is here, right? And you see the same story under voltage or under current flow. Equilibrium, the peak is here, that's the short bond corresponding to equilibrium. High voltage, the peak is over here, that's the place where it is in the metallic state. And you see that in the strong metallic, you see there's a region of phase coexistence at intermediate voltages where you see peaks in both places. But by the time you get up to this voltage, right, the insulating peak is just gone, right? Essentially, all the sample is transformed. It's not a case of filamentary metallic behavior fooling you, right? And from data like these, you can construct a kind of volume fraction phase diagram. This is done essentially at room temperature versus applied current or applied electric field. And the point is that what you see is low electric field metal, high electric field insulator. Other way around, sorry. Low electric field, 100% of the sample is insulator. 0% is metal, high electric field, 100% of the sample is metal, 0% is insulator, and then there's some little range in between where you get something. So to summarize, cooling this thing under current flow has produced some kind of genuinely non-equilibrium steady state, right, which doesn't have any of the obvious trivial explanations and which requires to be understood. All right. A second way of driving the system out of equilibrium, I said, was short pulse. Right? You can just blast the system in some way, make a short perturbation, shake it vigorously in some way, and see what happens. So this is my cartoon of the way you basically do this in the condensed matter physics context. You hit the system with a laser beam, and indeed it's slightly scary. The world is now full of people with large, powerful lasers looking for things to blast. Right. So you can blast samples which are insulators. So there's a band gap here. This is a crude sketch of zero temperature equilibrium. You have a valence band, a conduction band. The valence band is filled. The conduction band is empty. There's a gap between them. If you shine light on it, you excite particle hole pairs. If you shine a lot of light, you excite a high density of particle hole pairs. And then you can ask what happens. All right. So there is a very interesting paper that appeared in Science magazine about 10 months ago. Following on other experimental work relating to this material, VO2, which I referred to before. Now, this material has a metal insulator transition, crudely speaking, similar to the calcium ruthenate transition. As you lower the temperature, again, a bit above room temperature, that's here, you see a first order transition from a metallic state where the resistance is zero in the scale to an insulating state where the resistance is very high and increasing as you lower the temperature. You see it's first order because there's hysteresis and there's a jump. This metal insulator transition has been studied by many people, including some in this room, in equilibrium, and we know that it's associated with two things. One is a lattice distortion, which I've sort of tried to draw here. These red things are the vanadium atoms, and in the metallic phase, the vanadium atoms are distributed in a particular structure. In the insulating phase, they get dimerized. You find pairs of vanadiums which get close, like these two, these two, these two. So there's a kind of structural dimerization instability which is associated with this transition. However, this structural instability is not enough by itself to drive the insulating behavior. If you just perform, for example, a band structure calculation in the low temperature structure, the answer you get is a metal. So you require both a correlation effect and the structural effect to obtain this insulating phase. All right. Now, here is a band structure done treating the correlations in a very primitive Hartree-Fock way, which I put up just because I happen to have it and for orientation. So the insulating behavior is associated with the structural distortion, which leads to a dimerization. All right? And this dimerization is associated with a bonding-antibonding distortion of one of the particular vanadium d orbitals, which in these notations, for reasons I'm not going to attempt to defend, is the vanadium x squared minus y squared orbital. So what you see in the dimerized structure is the bonding-antibonding splitting that you associate with the dimerization. So you have an occupied x squared minus y squared and an empty. They're split, and then all the other orbitals are basically pushed up above the Fermi level with little tails having to do with some kind of weak hybridization. All right, so this is the insulating phase. It's associated, if you like, with an almost complete orbital ordering. The only states with significant occupancy that are below the Fermi level is this x squared minus y squared, the bonding part of the guy that participates in the dimerization. The other low-lying vanadium orbitals, the xz and the yz, lie above the Fermi level and are empty. Right, and you can see there's almost none of them down here. Okay, so that's just some background. Now, these people did the following experiment. They blasted this thing with a laser. They excited a density of particles above the gap. The measure of laser intensity and therefore the amount of energy they've put into the sample, the number of particles they excite, is something which the experimentalists call fluence. And the experimental fluences I'll be talking about correspond to exciting about 10% of making about 0.1 excitation per unit cell. A unit cell actually in these conventions has 4 vanadium, so 0.025 excitations per vanadium. Right? And so basically what they're doing is you're taking some holes out of here and you're putting them up here. All right. Now, This is a complicated figure, which I took directly from the experimental paper, all right? And it's probably not worth your while to look at this too closely. It will only give you a headache. But what they managed to do experimentally is two things. First, they measure time-resolved diffraction. So these are diffraction patterns, and they can measure it as a function of time, starting before they blast it, immediately after the blast, which is zero on this scale, and then going forward into the future. So you can watch the diffraction pattern evolve as a function of time. So up here is just the total diffraction pattern, and if you look very closely, you see this color bar, you can see that in each of these lines is actually an overlay of things with different colors corresponding to different times, and they change a little bit. And so these are different diffraction peaks which have names like 200 and 122 and so on. And you see there are places where the heights change a little bit, right? So that can be resolved. So you can see what happens to these various peaks. These are differences of various kinds. Okay, now, what I'd like you to focus on, or what the experimentalists would like us to focus on, is two things, all right? Two peaks. The important one is this one, which is 200 and its friend 220, right? And what you can see is that there's a certain delay time, and then the intensity goes up. There's also this peak, 302, where there's a rapid decrease, and then the intensity goes down. All right, now, what they say is the 302 peak is associated with the lattice distortion. This is the peak which is caused by the vanadium-vanadium dimerization position. It's really just showing you about the vanadium motion. Right. And what you can see from this lower plot is that, which plots change in the peak as a function of fluence, is that nothing happens for fluences less than about 10, and then you start getting changes. So the statement is that for if you blast it with moderate strengths in this region, nothing happens to the lattice. And you blast it harder and stuff happens. On the other hand, if you look at this thing, which is 220, and notice, by the way, there's a suppressed zero. Fluence 5 is here, fluence 0 is over here. You see a kind of smooth increase in the strength of this peak. So, and this peak, they say, relates to the occupancy of different electron orbitals, the degree to which you're taking electrons out of dx squared minus y squared and putting them in dxz. So you get a steady change in electron occupancy, but there's a range where nothing happens to the lattice. All right, and finally, this is a measure of whether the thing is metallic or insulating. When you do these experiments, when you take a thing and put it in your free electron laser and blast it, it's hard to do a conventional transport experiment. Right? However, what you can do is shine another light beam at a frequency you like on it and see whether the light beam is transmitted or not. And basically, if the frequency of your light is less than the gap frequency, if you have an insulator, it's transmitted. And on the other hand, if you have a metal, then the metallic electrons absorb light and it's not transmitted. So this is transmission as a function of time.
So yeah. If you look at the smooth variation, can you really say from this data that it's smooth?
No. This one, I think, but all I want you to see is that it's not flat in this region. All right? Well, but even more, and in fact, I guess I agree with that statement. But the only thing which is important for my argument, actually, I should have said this better, thank you for saying that. This red thing is not just flat, but within error bars, which are not as small as you would like, consistent with zero. This thing, whether it's flat or not, is not consistent with zero. So something has happened to the electrons and nothing has happened to the lattice. For this purpose, let's just leave it at that. Okay, now here I blew up this IR transmittance. Notice this number 3.7, and notice this number 10. You're down here somewhere where nothing is happening to the lattice.
Sorry, I guess I missed this point. 220 is just another diffraction.
Their statement is that this diffraction pattern is reflecting changes in orbital occupancy, although it is, of course, just the diffraction peak. Whereas their statement is that 302 is a purely lattice one. Correct. Yes. Yes. And this is something where we have to go over the paper. I'm just quoting the statements at the moment that they make in the paper.
Okay.
All right. Here, you will notice that if you do small fluence, you blast it, the transmittance goes from being essentially perfect, because this is a thin film and you don't get any significant reflection. Actually, I think this is normalized to take out the reflection. Right? It goes down because you blasted it, and then it goes back. Maybe not all the way back, but back. Right? On the other hand, if you blast it harder than about 3, the transmittance just goes down to 0 and stays there. And you can continue this out to as long as they care to watch, tens or hundreds of picoseconds, and the transmittance stays 0. Right? So if you blast it harder than a quite small amount, right, you change the state, at least as far as this experiment is concerned, from insulating to metallic. You make a very long-lived change in the state, in the electronic state, even though, according to this, you have not done anything to the vanadium-vanadium dimerization. Right. So the interpretation, which I don't want to defend here in detail, is that if you go back to what they say this 220 is that you start over here with the insulating band structure I showed you. You have the two dimerized x squared minus y squared, and then you have the other xz, yz, right? That what has happened is that you have deoccupied some of this and added more electrons in some other orbital, right? So you have a long-lived rearrangement of the orbital occupancy of the electrons, which leads to a metallic state, even though you haven't done anything to the lattice. Right? So the response to a transient perturbation, if the amplitude is large enough, but not too large to just totally mess up the structure, is apparently to put you into a different metastable electronic state with different properties. And the threshold is relatively low. You're talking about 10% of excitations per unit cell. All right. So there's a lot more to say about this, and I'll come back to this in subsequent weeks. But to my mind, there are several experiments of this nature, and it poses a challenge to theory and thinking, right? That there's experimental evidence, again, that a transient perturbation of appropriate amplitude can change the electronic state to a new long-lived metastable state. And you have to understand, where can that come from and what are its properties? All right. Yep. Yes, but correct. So basically, that's something which I'll come back to. But basically, there's a moderately high electron temperature, and to my mind, the big open theoretical question is how quick can you get that temperature down to the lattice temperature? It's clear that there are kinetic barriers to radiator to recombination, let's say, and the question is, all our estimates are that just the simple kinetic barriers to recombination are actually still lead to timescales which are short compared to what they see. So you want to have some other energy barrier in there. You want there really to be a different electronic state with a kind of collective energy barrier against recombination. But then the degree to which that can really live depends on how quick phonons can take energy out of the system. And that's unknown at the moment, at least to me. All right. So the final set of experiments that I wanted to mention is AC drive. And again, you've heard about this, and I don't want to go too deep into it. There is a recent paper on the archive which follows work on other materials. This is from the group of Cavallari, and I'm sure you've heard about this. But for various materials, in this particular case, a member of the carbon-60 family, you take a material and you excite to a relatively high degree a particular phonon. An optically active phonon, because the way you do this is you shine light on it. So light couples to things with a dipole matrix element, right? So there's a sketch here which I took from their paper, which shows the distortions involved in the phonon mode. So you take this thing, which is a superconductor below 30 Kelvin in equilibrium, and you shake it in a way that just deforms the local carbon 60 units. And if the amplitude of the shaking is large enough, right, you get a remarkable effect. The remarkable effect is shown here. Basically, red is equilibrium without shaking. Blue is the change after you shake it, or in the presence of shaking, I should say. Right? So if this thing is continuously irradiated with this high amplitude electric field, which is tuned to this particular phonon energy and shakes the thing, what you see is a dramatic decrease of the real part of the conductivity in some frequency range which they can measure. And again, this is one of these things where you take the sample and you put it in a laser, in a intense laser beam at a synchrotron facility. So there are not very many experiments you can do, and in particular, it's hard to attach wires and make a DC conductivity. So this is measured in some intermediate frequency, right? So what you see is a strong decrease of the conductivity in some frequency, of the real part of the conductivity in some frequency range, and a strong increase in the imaginary part. So what that says, if you think about the Kramers-Kronig relation, is you take the area which is lost here, the difference in area between the red and the blue, and you move it to a frequency which is below the experimentally accessible range. You have to move it to a frequency which is below. That's the only way to get this to go up. If you moved it above, this would go down. Right? So that kind of change, first of the most important thing is that you're making a change which is of the order of unity. You've done a order one change to the electronic properties. The second thing is that this qualitative behavior, strong decrease in the real part, strong increase in the imaginary part, is strongly suggestive of superconductivity. That's what superconductivity does. It takes conductivity spectral weight in some frequency below the gap, and it moves it to a delta function at zero. Right? And then if you look at an intermediate frequency, you see decrease in real part, increase in imaginary part. Now here, obviously, they don't have any direct evidence that it's superconducting. There's no delta, they can't access the delta function. They haven't done any measurement to know that. But just qualitatively, you're making an order one change which is strongly suggestive of superconductivity. And if it's not superconductivity, it's something else interesting. Okay, so to summarize, what I've tried to persuade you of in this beginning part of the lectures is that modest amplitude non-equilibrium drives can change the state of a correlated electron material in an interesting way, right? And essentially, the challenge for physics, it seems to me, is to understand what's going on here. All right. And I want to, yeah. But bear in mind that that's why the increase in the reactive part is significant. The way you get the reactive part to go up is you increase the area in sigma 1 at a frequency lower than what you're measuring. Right? So if you create a gap and you take that spectral wave and either you erase it completely or you push it to high frequency, then the reactive part goes down. Right? That's why this is interesting. Again, there's no proof that it's superconductivity, but the natural assertion is that you've taken a good fraction of the area, which is lost between these two, and moved it to a lower frequency. All right? And so it's not just opening a gap. If you open a gap in the standard insulator way, you take that missing area and move it to a higher frequency. Right? And then sigma 2 would not go up. Right? Now, okay, so, but look, these are the facts, and I think it's fair to say that there is no coherent theoretical interpretation of them. But there is plainly a phenomenon here that's interesting, whether or not it's superconductivity. And as I said, it's strongly suggestive of superconductivity. All right, so, yeah. Sorry? Yeah, yeah, it goes away essentially immediately. This requires the drive to exist. In contrast to the VO2 experiment I showed you where you blast it and then there's a long-lived change, this one, as far as I understand, as I say, it's requires the drive and it goes away very rapidly when you turn off the drive. Okay. Right. So this is just more words for what I said before. Okay, so we want to understand, therefore, the non-equilibrium properties of correlated electron systems, and this is hard for two reasons. First, the correlated electrons part, and second, the non-equilibrium part. Okay, so I just want to make some very simple remarks about why these things are hard. All right, first, here is a generic Hamiltonian for, let's say, written in first quantized notation. So you have the kinetic energy of the electrons, whatever potential they feel from the ions they're in, and the electron-electron interaction. All right. In fact, what you should do is incorporate most of the electron-electron interaction into some kind of effective mean field-like single particle potential. There's lots of ways of doing this, band theory, Hartree-Fock approximation, etc. All right. But Quite a lot of this just gives you a mean field which should live inside this. All right? But once you've done this, you have one part of the Hamiltonian which is non-interacting electrons moving in some kind of effective potential. And then you have the residual interactions, and I denoted by colons here some kind of normal ordering to say that it's the residual part of the interaction that isn't included in the mean field theory. Right? And again, it's not worth going into details about how you exactly do that. Okay, so for many materials are what we would call weakly correlated, which means that some kind of renormalized single particle picture applies. More or less you can focus on this and treat this by perturbation theory. Right? Strongly correlated means you can't do that, that there are important aspects of the physics which are outside of a simple quasi-particle description. Okay, now I'll come back in 1 minute to why that's particularly important in this case. But let me say briefly about equilibrium and non-equilibrium. As you all know, if you study equilibrium systems, the key quantity is the partition function, just the sum over all states with the energy of each state divided by the temperature. You can express this as some kind of imaginary time integral, and this gives you a mathematical and conceptual structure which allows you to understand a lot of things without actually solving the problem in detail. Right? Furthermore, if you want to do numerics to solve some part of the problem in detail, right, the object you have to deal with is basically, the numerical problem you have to deal with is basically estimating combinations of decaying exponentials. Right? And that's a doable thing numerically. There are complications associated with the fermion sign problem and so on, but decaying exponentials is a good thing to try to estimate from a numerical point of view. Now, if you go out of equilibrium, the thing which replaces the partition function is the density matrix. Right? Now, the density matrix is a product, an outer product of two wave functions, so it has to have two time evolution operators. Therefore, you have to do some kind of two-contour path integral. Right? And you have two problems. First, there's very little understanding of the general structure of this. What you really do in practice is you start from a known initial, a known or assumed initial condition, and you just integrate forward and see what you get. Right? We don't have the conceptual structure of phases and fixed points to guide us that we do in the equilibrium case. Right? The second point is that your numerical life is much worse. Not only do you have two contours instead of one, but what you have to do is estimate combinations of oscillating exponentials. All the convergence is provided by cancellation of oscillations. And that makes your life much, much, much worse from a numerical point of view. Okay. So, even so, this is essentially doable if you're considering weakly correlated materials because you have a well-defined starting point, just non-interacting electrons, which you know how to time evolve, and low-order perturbation theory more or less tells you what you want to know. Right? So the integration here is manageable. But if you go away from a quasi-particle picture, then it's not clear what to do. Right. So that, in a very qualitative sense, is the problem. Now, let me expand on that a little bit. In equilibrium physics, our conceptual framework really comes from writing the partition function as some kind of imaginary time path integral. I wrote the equality in quotation marks here because this kind of thing still makes mathematicians a bit ill. But in general, you have a partition function can be expressed as some kind of path integral over configurations of fields. And in many cases, this path integral is dominated by a saddle point, a most probable field configuration, plus the leading order fluctuations, which are Gaussian. So I wrote it like this. Phi is supposed to be some combination of many different kinds of fields. And in many equilibrium cases, in fact, the structure that we think of for equilibrium is that your path integral is dominated by a saddle point, and then there are fluctuations. And your task as a physicist is to identify the appropriate stationary point, saddle point, which defines a phase of matter, and identify the important fluctuations, the things you should put in here to look at for the corrections to your fixed point approximation. These are the particles or quasi-particles. And finally, to obtain the susceptibilities, here I wrote the inverse susceptibility, which are the quasi-particle propagators or linear response functions of the theory. Right? So that's the intellectual structure which we use to understand equilibrium physics. right? Now, and in fact, basically this structure and this idea of focusing on the leading order fluctuating fields and the susceptibility applies to a large degree in equilibrium, even if you can't restrict yourself just to the Gaussian approximation. In particular, at a critical point, a second order phase transition, nonlinearities are important. But really, what the nonlinearities do is they change what you mean, perhaps, by the important fields, and they put various peculiarities into the form of the susceptibility. They give it exponents and things like that. But still, what we want to think about is the linear response susceptibility. All right. So now, what I want to do in the rest of this talk is argue that even on the equilibrium level, this picture is missing something fundamental for correlated electron materials. Right? And what it's missing should guide us in how we think about the non-equilibrium problems. All right. So let me go back to phenomenology of correlated electron materials. I showed you this before. This is the metal-insulator transition of VO2. This is the superconducting transition of YbCO. These are just two examples to tell you that correlated electron materials do interesting things. All right. This is what I just said. And now I want to expand on this a little bit. All right. The first point is that the interesting electronic behavior is very often associated in some way with a lattice distortion. In vanadium dioxide, as I said, an apparently important ingredient in getting the insulating phase is this dimerization lattice distortion, where you pick pairs and they get close together like the ones I drew a circle around here. In the rare earth nickelates, the metal insulator transition, which occurs for these guys here, is associated with a bond disproportionation, where you take your nickel ions and take every second one of them and make the mean nickel oxygen distance short. The other one correspondingly gets long. That's what's shown here. You go through the transition, and instead of all the octahedra having the same bond length, you get some long, some short. Right. The lattice distortion by itself isn't enough to produce insulating behavior. Either in the vanadates, where if you just do a density functional calculation, which is shown, I hope you can see it, in these dashed lines, you get states at the Fermi level, or similarly in the nickelates. All right. As another example, which should also be well known to this audience, the canonical so-called Mott insulating material is the lanthanum or yttrium titanates. I show here their optical conductivity just to show you that these things have a gap. Now, this gap is associated with two things. One is electron correlations, and the other is changes in crystal structure corresponding to rotations of the transition metal oxygen octahedron. Right? So these materials we think of as being in structures which are derived from a cubic perovskite form. Right? I've sketched the cubic perovskite here. But in all the materials which are insulating, there is a so-called gadolinium ferrite distortion in which the octahedra tilt and rotate, as is sketched here. The typical rotation angles are 10 to 20 degrees. They buckle the bonds a little bit. Without it, you don't get them to be insulating. So this is a material which has no rotations, and it's not insulating. This is a material which has some rotations. It's insulating. This is a bit more rotations, and it's more insulating. All right. So I'll just skip more or less over this, except to say, sorry, I didn't mean to keep going back and forth. In the copper oxide superconductivity, you have a qualitative phase diagram with a superconducting region. This can be preempted by an insulating phase, which suppresses the superconductivity. This is the transition temperature for one particular high TC material. It's redrawn again here. This is the superconducting phase boundary for pure lanthanum strontium copper oxide. If you add some neodymium, you get this. What this neodymium does is it tilts the octahedra a little bit, inducing some kind of insulating phase, which competes with and preempts the superconductivity. All right. So what that says is that modest change, A, these metal insulator transitions are coupled to the lattice, and B, modest changes in the crystal structure can drive the transition and produce a big effect. Right? What that means is that there is the characteristic of these materials is that there's a large, essentially nonlinear response to an external perturbation. You change things only a relatively little bit, and you push the material into a different phase. So what I would like to argue is that while the standard condensed matter physics point of view is that you should focus on the linear response susceptibility. The key feature of these materials is a large nonlinear response. Right? And to drive that point home, I want to show some data which I have always admired on this family of materials, lanthanum strontium manganese oxide. They display the canonical correlated electron behavior of many different phases shown on phase diagrams with many different colors. I just want to draw your attention here to the fact that there is a ferromagnetic metal phase as a function of strontium concentration x, which gives way at small x to various kinds of insulating phases. All right. Now, you can ask what happens if you put a modest amount of impurities into this material. Right? So what the people in this paper did was they substituted a little bit of aluminum for the manganese. And as you expect, if you substitute a little bit of aluminum, the resistance goes up. Right? This is one thing here near the edge of the phase. This is another thing here in the middle of the metallic phase. You add more aluminum, the resistance goes up. Big deal, you say. We know you add disorder, resistance goes up. What's interesting is to plot the residual resistivity, the value that it goes to is at low temperature, against aluminum concentration. And what you see is that there is an initial slope, as long as you're away, not right at the insulating phase boundary, there's an initial slope, which is the same here at point 2 and here at point 3. And this slope, trust me, is basically of the magnitude you expect from conventional physics. You just apply standard Matheson's rule kind of arguments, and it gives you this slope. And then you see there's a threshold above which the resistivity rockets up. Right? So the characteristic behavior of the characteristic response of this material to a perturbation, in this case impurity, is a regime of linear response where the response is not particularly enhanced, and then a threshold which occurs at a rather small concentration to a different behavior. And as you go towards this phase boundary, the thing that really changes is the threshold and not really the initial slope. Right? So again, what you see is that the nonlinear response is important, and the threshold to interesting nonlinear behavior changes as you move around in the phase diagram. So to summarize, what I wanted to say about transition metal oxides is that they exhibit interesting electronic behavior. It's tightly coupled to the lattice. There are many ways to tweak the behavior, many of which come down to controlling the lattice. And modest perturbations lead to big responses associated with changing electronic phase. All right? And that is the context in which you should think about these non-equilibrium experiments. That the key thing you want to get your hands on is the nonlinear response and the threshold to being in another phase. Okay. Now, what I would like to do for about 10 minutes, if I can, is just open up a little sidebar. Right. Which is, I think, interesting, related to this, and is related to what I've told you about so far, but in a way which still isn't fully clear to me. Right. So this is going to be closer to a research report or a seminar. I'm going to report work that I did with Abhay Passapathy, a brilliant experimentalist at Columbia, and Rafael Fernandez, who's now at the University of Minnesota. All right. So we're going to talk about a different correlated electron material, namely the parent compound of the iron arsenide superconductors. So this is sodium iron arsenide. It's a material which is not superconducting, although if you tweak it a little bit, it becomes superconducting. And it has three electronic phases. It has a high temperature phase, which was believed to be an ordinary metal. Actually, this one is superconducting now that I see. Its resistance has gone to zero. But it has two transitions, a structural phase transition and an antiferromagnetic transition. The antiferromagnetic, so this is a sketch of what happens. At high temperatures, the thing is in a tetragonal phase, so the two iron-iron distances are the same. At this T delta, it goes to an orthorhombic phase in which one iron distance gets longer and the other one gets shorter. All right, I've tried to draw so the vertical one gets shorter, the horizontal one gets longer. And then below the nail temperature, you get a stripe antiferromagnet. So you go in one direction, in fact, the shorter bond, all the moments point the same way. You go in the orthogonal direction, they alternate. So that's a stripe magnetic order. Okay, now this stripe magnetic order scatters the electrons and rearranges the Fermi surface. Right? This has been measured, for example, in photo emission. You look at high temperature and you see a Fermi surface which is more or less circular. You look at low temperature and it's split up into these spots. And this can be at least easily understood in terms of band calculations. Basically, you have a Fermi surface that consists of a central hole pocket and outer electron pocket. If you have stripe antiferromagnetism of the kind I showed you, basically you leave these guys alone. You mix this state with this state. If you just do the coupling of this to this, you go from a circular Fermi surface to opening up gaps where the Fermi surfaces intersect. Fine. So none of this is very surprising. Right. Now let's look at the surprising part. And to show you the surprising part, I have to digress a little bit into this quasi-particle interference business. If you take an impurity and you put it into an electron gas, it makes, as Friedel in this city knew many, many years ago, standing waves in the electron distribution. Right? It's a point source, it scatters the electrons, it makes standing waves that have to do with the Fermi wave vector of the electrons. Right? So the spatial, the period, and indeed the spatial structure, I've drawn it here circular, but of course in a real material you don't have circular symmetry. So the structure of these standing waves depends on the Fermi surface. Right? Now this is just for one. If you have many impurities, the waves, each one launches a wave, they interfere with each other, you get a more complicated structure. But it's the same basic conclusion. You get a pattern of standing waves, which you can relate back to properties of the Fermi surface. It's a separate discussion, which I don't want to take the time to go into here, but it's sort of interesting to explain how you actually do that. But let's just say it can be done. All right. So here are some data. What they do is, using scanning probe measurements with atomic resolution, you measure the tunneling density of states point by point along the material. These standing waves produce spatial variation of the density of states, which depends both on the energy at which you measure it and the position. And by measuring this over a wide area, you can back out what the Fermi surface was, or the electron states were, that produce this pattern. Right? So here are data in real space, which don't look like much. You Fourier transform them and so on, and you get a structure, right, which depends on energy and so on. And what you see at low temperatures is, and at relatively low energies, is a strong anisotropy. Right? You see there's clearly a preferred direction. There are regions where it's zero. You don't get circles.
Right.
And you go far away from the Fermi level, and things go back to being more or less circular. All right. So basically, if you just take what you know about the Fermi surface and you feed it into the standard methodology, you figure out what the standing waves would be from a set of randomly positioned impurities and ask what the implications would be for the experiment, you get this. Right? Which is not too dissimilar from this. Right? So these patterns, in particular, you have a spatial anisotropy, you have a structure with strong intensities and weak intensities. Right? So what this experiment is observing is the reconstruction of the Fermi surface by this existing spin density wave. Again, so far, not at all surprising. Right? The surprise is the following. As you raise the temperature, you go through the magnetic transition, you lose the spin density wave ordering, you expect the structure to go away. Right? So if I do a naive calculation of the Fermi surface, then in the low temperature phase, I get this. In the intermediate phase, where I have this tetragonal to orthorhombic distortion, I get something like this. I've exaggerated the anisotropy, but you'll notice that because you've lost the magnetism, you now have something which, where the intensity is pretty close to uniform, and then you go up to higher temperature and you just get basically circles. All right? And this is not what happens experimentally. So these are the data as you go up in temperature, from lowest temperature, higher, 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 higher. So the structure persists well above the 43 Kelvin transition temperature, up to at least 85 or 90 Kelvin. Okay. So that's experimental fact that this kind of structure, which at low temperature we associate with the presence of a spin density wave, persists to temperatures a factor of 2 or higher above the spin density wave transition temperature. Right? Experimentalists and also glossy journals like Nature Physics prefer three-dimensional plots with colors. I find it easier to understand if you just do line cuts. So if you just take one of these patterns and you plot the intensity as you go along a line like that, right? The characteristic you see here is three peaks, peak, 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 right? So this is a particular line cut, this one, and you see you have peaks at low temperature. They basically persist in position and amplitude up to quite high temperature. If you were to just take the naive expectation of what happens to the Fermi surface, basically the structure should go away. All right. So the basic physical idea, which is not new, is that you have regions, even though you have, it is on average in a paramagnetic phase. So you have no long-range magnetic order. You have local regions of magnetic order. All right. So the regions will have some size. They'll have some amplitude. And these regions will affect the electronic dynamics basically if the size of the gap, basically if the, I have the inequality reversed. Basically what you want is that the local gap is big enough that when an electron goes through, it's scattered several times as it goes through before it gets out. So that means if I take the inverse time, Fermi velocity divided by the scale, right? It should be lower than the gap, right? So I'm sorry if this inequality is the wrong way around. But if that's the case, then the electrons will feel the gap before they exit the region. All right. So you can take that idea, which goes back at least to the 70s. You can implement it in a simple mathematical ansatz, which I learned from Patrick Lee, where you just say the electron self-energy is the gap, and then this is the amplitude to backscatter across the Fermi surface, and then there's a broadening to do with the correlation length. And this is a formula which doesn't really have a theoretical justification, but encodes this physics reasonably well. Right? And for those of you who are want the technical details, this gives you the broadened backscattering without coherence, without the density wave coherence factors. Right? So you can take this kind of self-energy, you can put it into the standard formalism and recalculate what the quasi-particle interference pattern is and see what you get. Right? And again, if you like three-dimensional pictures, you can get various structures. You can vary the correlation length and see what happens. And the basic point is that to get a line cut which has the structure that you want, what you need in this, you can do that within this kind of calculation. And what you need is two things. You need to keep the gap amplitude approximately at this, at its t equals zero value. And indeed, you see this just from these data, right? The peak positions here, the outer peaks haven't gotten closer to the inner peaks or anything like that, right? And you need to have a correlation length which is not too short. If the correlation length becomes too short, the whole effect just gets averaged out, right? So in other words, what this calculation tells you is that the data imply that you have large amplitude, slow fluctuations of this density wave order, which persist at least up until twice the nominal transition temperature, right? And are strong enough to actually reconstruct the Fermi surface in the vicinity of where they are. In other words, the paramagnetic phase has a hidden structure, right? Which is only revealed by putting these finite perturbations. Now, this is just poetry. In other words, what I want you to think of is that in this material, well, we used to think of electronic systems above their phase transition as a Fermi sea, a relatively placid lake with modest ripples. All right? And what these results suggest is an alternative picture in which you have giant waves moving slowly through this thing which you thought was just a modest Fermi sea. Right? So another way to say this is that these experiments indicate a large amplitude response to impurities, a large local reconstruction of the Fermi surface, and again, therefore, a large nonlinear response. Okay, so to summarize, All of these things provide a context for non-equilibrium correlated electronic physics, which is multiplicity of electronic phases, important coupling to lattice, large nonlinear response associated with the change of electronic phase. So that's basically all I wanted to say here. And then next time, I will start in on what is known from a different context, namely controlled experiments in cold atoms, and the theoretical results which have been obtained in that context. And then I will develop from there to which parts we can carry over to correlated electrons and which parts we cannot. So thank you for your attention, and I'll stop here.